Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside scoop on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can always find us on RestaurantGuysRadio.com and the Heritage Radio Network. We're, of course, on iTunes.
Hi there, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you doing this morning?
Good, man. How are you doing?
I'm well. What was your family's favorite restaurant when you were a kid? You know, old enough to remember, 7, 8, 9 to 14, 15?
There was a little seafood house that my parents used to take us to that was a place called Coy's in Rutherford.
Did they serve Coy?
Rutherford.
That's illegal.
I don't know. It was called Coy's. Okay. I think that was the guy's name.
Oh, okay, all right. Not the fish they served.
And I was little, and I was like, do you have anything that's not fish?
That's funny. That's no. Can I tell, I just want to interject here with your story with my story, because I'm rude like that. We moved when I was very young from Orange, New Jersey, which was a town that was about a third Irish, a third Italian, and a third black. And yeah, I know there were two Protestant guys that lived there, but you know, just, I know. But generally, it was, that's what the ethnic makeup of it, and that was everybody I knew. And it was a really diverse community, and it was a very urban community. My family had been there since they came over in the potato famine. And we moved to Livingston. Well, I honestly had never met a Jewish person in my life in Orange. There just wasn't a large Jewish population there. And so we moved when I'm at the end of grammar, or in the middle of grammar school. And one of my best friends, we played G.I. Joe's together, was Adam Lippman. And Adam's father owned the local Cohen's Canisius. And so he said, my dad owns a restaurant. I was like, that's really cool, you know, because we were all civil servants back in Orange. Nobody owned anything. And we went into the Cohen's Canisius, and Mr. Lippman was really great and really nice to us.
My kids think it's cool too, or they did. Now they know better.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So anyway, so we go to Cohen's Canisius, and I remember I sat down, and I was with Mrs. Lippman and Adam and his brother, and I ordered a cheeseburger. Cohen's Canisius is kosher. And they laughed at me. And I was like, I don't understand. What's kosher?
All these rules.
What's kosher? Anyway, sorry. So Coy's restaurant was your family's favorite restaurant.
Yeah, it was just a place that my dad really liked. It was a, you know, sit-down restaurant. It wasn't, you know, it was a real restaurant.
Mr. Coy there?
It was, you know, it was a family restaurant, but it was a real restaurant.
Was Mr. Coy?
Probably. You know, I was not in tune with the goings-on of a restaurant as a 7, 8, 9-year-old.
The restaurant in Orange was Libretti's, mm-hmm. and Mr. Libretti was in the kitchen, and Mrs. Libretti was out front. And
we didn't go to Italian restaurants. Well, Catherine Lombardi. It was the Italian restaurant.
Sorry, it was your grandmother.
But it was the actual Catherine Lombardi.
Yeah, no. Well, we went to Italian restaurants because Minnie Hackett boiled everything. Minnie Hackett boiled everything. And so once in a while, we wanted not boiled food. Occasionally, we'd broil everything, but that was it. Boil and broil. That's all we had. So, but we went to Libretti's, and Mr. Libretti was there, and I remember thinking, wow, this food is so good. No one ever makes food like this at home. There were a bunch of local restaurants. We mm-hmm. knew the people that owned the Irish bars and the Italian restaurants that we went to. I knew Mr. Lippman at Cohen's Canisius, mm-hmm. and I knew never to order a cheeseburger again mm-hmm. after that.
You talk about the sit-down restaurant, but not just a sit-down. I mean, whether you went to Roth's Deli, Mr. Roth was there.
Yeah.
Mr. Roth's daughter worked the slicer. And,
right.
You know, and people from the neighborhood worked in the place, and it was in the downtown, and, there were all kinds of places like that.
Well, here's
There's a place in Nutley's, you know, just now that I know where you're going. It's a place called Scotto's, okay, mm-hmm. a little mm-hmm. pizzeria on the Nutley-Clifton border. And, you know, I happened in there not too long ago, and Mr. Scotto is still there. Now, it's 40 years since Scotto's opened.
Right.
So Mr. Scotto's old. Okay.
They're going to be saying that about you one day, mister.
I think they're already saying it.
Yeah.
But, you know, those types of places with the people and the personalities were, you know, part of your childhood, part of the community.
You know, there's the Star Tavern in Orange, New Jersey, which is still there. And Orange is a beleaguered town, and the Star Tavern is still open every night. And it's in a high crime area, so they post a policeman outside of the Star Tavern every night. If you can go to the Star Tavern in Orange, New Jersey, go have the pizza there. It's about the pizza. And I just, you know, I wasn't sure who owned it still, and I got in a conversation. I went to pick up a bunch of pies after a wake and funeral recently, and we went back and ate pizza after the wake. And I got to talking to the guy in the kitchen, and he is the son of, he's the third generation that owns the Star Tavern. Mm. And he, you know, I don't remember the story very well, but he had some other profession, and it came time to either sell it or pass it to the next generation, and he left that other profession and went back to, and he's there making pizza every night, and he loves it.
Boy,
part of the community.
I hope my children don't make that decision.
Yeah. So there's an article that I read recently. It's actually on a blog. It's on culinary.careeredu.blog. And it talks about the death of the mom and pop restaurant, or the mom and pop restaurants being less frequent, and especially outside the cities, you see, you know, the landscape dominated by chain restaurants.
You know, just to take it back to Nutley, to my old childhood town, and I guess the Cranford, the town I live in now, is pretty similar to this. You see the chain restaurants when you go out to the highway, out on Route 3, you know, in Clifton, there's the Bennigan's and the Applebee's, and, well, not Bennigan's anymore, but Applebee's and all the chain restaurants that you would find anywhere else. But when you go into the town, yeah, there's a Dunkin' Donuts or a Starbucks or something like that, but all the restaurants in the town are mom and pop restaurants. They're owned by you know, people who run these little 2,200 square foot restaurants, and they're the whole show.
And they depend on you, people with good taste, to not only go yourself but you must bully your friends and make fun of them when they go to chain restaurants and tell them they have to go to the local restaurant and they don't have any taste and they're idiots because, no, you don't have to be that. I'm exaggerating, obviously, I'm using hyperbole, but you know, if we want mom and pop restaurants to exist, look, there's the Cheesecake Factory. There are cheesecake factories all across the country that serve the same exact food. If you're in San Antonio, if you're in New Jersey, if you're in Miami, it's the same exact food. And, you know, it's all made by a corporation. Do we really want to eat that way?
A giant corporation in a commissary somewhere. You know, you have to look at what's going on in these places. Do we care about having those kinds of choices, about having those mom and pops, whether it's the hardware store, and you know, you got to look at it. This, it's not just restaurants,
right?
It's the hardware store. It's all those little services that you have in your town. You know, do you want Roto-Rooter to be your only choice for when the sewer backs up?
But it's more. I think that restaurants are the last bastion because you know what, the hardware store is almost done. And look, I supported my local hardware store. I still have a local hardware store in Metuchen, New Jersey. I support it whenever I can. But you know, you go to the hardware store and you spend 10 minutes, and you buy a thing.
Right.
You go to a restaurant partially for the food, and partially for the company and being in the community. It's the role of a pub. Go look up our TEDx talk on pubs and being a publican, and that's that's a much more important role of a restaurant. And if it's the mall instead of the downtown commons, if it's only in big corporations, that corporation can never be a part of your particular local community, well, like the independently owned restaurant.
And I guess there's one other point that I want to make about this that I think is really, really relevant, and I think it's a point that gets overlooked, and frankly, Francis and I overlook it a lot. Our corporation's sole purpose is to make a profit. That's their job. That's what they need to do. The corporation, the people in the corporation need to make a profit, and if that means doing something that's cool and trendy or acting in a certain way because it will make you do something, that's their job. They do it because they are profit motivated.
Well, and they may give to the local baseball team because they've done a study that shows that
because
that
it's good advertising, because it will raise their profits. They do not give to a baseball team because it's the altruistic thing to do or because they're part of the community. What happens with local businesses is they do a lot of the things that they do in their local business because they're people, and because they're part of the community, and because they know you, and because they are part of your life.
And they want to feel proud when they walk down the streets, and the corporation doesn't feel proud when they
walk down
the street.
Well, the corporation doesn't care. The corporation wants the street to be nice so that it can make more profit. And listen, profits are a part of any business. Francis and I talk about that all the time. But what has to happen is people need to understand that the large corporation who's got to answer to the stockholders, and that is their prime directive, is going to act differently and be different in your life than the small entrepreneur or proprietor who is part of your community.
And there's the debate now about whether or not corporations are people, and in many ways that our courts look on the corporations as people. Someone has said recently, I believe that corporations are people when Texas executes one. You know, that's just it's different. It's a business entity who is responsible to make money. Anyway, but here's the statistic I saw on this culinary.careeredu.blog that scared me in the course of a discussion. And it said he talks about how the chain restaurants have huge advantages of scale in reducing prices.
Absolutely.
How they have huge advantages of scale in design teams and legal teams, and talked about how they have an advertising budget that small mom and pops, I mean, no small mom and pop can afford an advertisement on the television, on network television, ever, anywhere. And it says it's a real problem for small restaurants as these Applebee's, Chili's, Cheesecake Factory, Ruby Tuesdays are now targeting smaller towns and not to just be on the highways. And here's the statistic it quoted that I wanted to share with people. Back in the 1970s, the market share, this is a quote, back in the 1970s, the market share for independent restaurants was about 85% independent restaurants. Things changed quickly in the 1980s when restaurant chain operators fine-tuned their business operations, blah, 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 blah. The domestic restaurant market share for restaurant chains, you want to take a guess at what it is now? Chains are make up what percentage of restaurants?
75.
88%.
Wow. And just so that, so it's completely flipped on its head.
Yeah. So
what was 15% is now 88%.
Right. Yeah. And you know, look, I don't begrudge the chain's success and a measure and a share of the pie. But if you want there to be...
I get it, a share of the pie.
It's funny. Or the cheesecake, as it were. But if you want there to be diversity in your town, if you want there to be diversity when you travel across America...
Well, and if you want these, if you want the place you go out to dinner to care about you as a person and not you as a pocketbook, then you've got to go to those types of places.
And you got to pressure your friends to do the same thing. And one of the things that is always cited by one of the problems that that one of the great advantages that chains have in destination places is they say that people want, because I see this all the time, I see people in Manhattan go into the chain restaurant, go into the Ruby Tuesdays, and I'm thinking, you're in Times Square in Manhattan. There are 100 restaurants within 5 blocks of you that are some of the best restaurants in the world. And, you know, people want to go to something that's familiar. And I think we need to have we need to take a chance on restaurants that we're not familiar with. And especially when you've got online resources to go and look up things with.
Yeah, they can make you familiar with the type of food they have, what you're looking for, if it's the type of place you want, if it's kid friendly. There are so many resources to tell you whether a restaurant is for you or not. That there's really no excuse to, but I will say, you know, you talked about marketing. You know, there are millions and millions, 100 millions of people in this country who, when they drive past McDonald's, have all of that since they were babies.
Yeah.
You know, drilled into their head that they're like, hey, McDonald's, that's a place that has good food and a place that I want to go. And it's literally brainwashed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Into their head. You know, I was talking to somebody about that the other day. You know, how could they still be doing as well as they're doing, you know, given, you know, the world today? And one is prices, and the other one is that they have drilled that into people that you know, I don't want to say brainwashing because
it's just an innate reaction. They've given you a positive response with regard to food, and you got to go there. So what I'm saying is, let's look for the little independent burger place down the road, and let's encourage our friends to do the same thing. And hey, we're going to talk in just a moment with a guy named David Hansen. He's written a book about urban farming. So we'll go from talking about restaurant food to growing your own food. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys at RestaurantGuysRadio.com and the Heritage Radio Network. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. And our guest today is David Hansen. He is a freelance journalist living in Seattle. He was the founding travel editor for Cottage Living magazine, and he's now editor-at-large for Coastal Living. He writes for magazines all across America about subjects that are near and dear to our heart. And his book is Breaking Through the Concrete, Building an Urban Farm Revival.
David Hansen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, David, it seems to a lot of people that farm and city are two opposite ends of the spectrum. Yet, what about urban farming? Why a book about urban farming?
Well, because it's happening. You know, the old because it's there, I guess, works here. And a lot of people don't really know that there are urban farms, and more and more. And then beyond that, they don't know exactly what those urban farms are doing. They might see them on the street corner. But we wanted to kind of piece together across the country what we think is a sort of movement going on in the food and within our food system.
Well, let's start with the most basic of questions, David. Why do you think this movement's happening? What's the impetus of a movement like this?
That's obviously it's basic and gigantic. I mean, I think there's tons of social factors like there would be anything that you could consider kind of a movement like this. You know, people, there's, I think there's a lot of movement back toward, people want to know where they're, where the things they use and consume are coming from. And you see that in clothing and then just this, and in food. And I think that the kind of eco-conscious movement that we have growing now, whether it's because of a lot of talk of climate change or just another generation coming along that's a little more conscientious. But all of that, I think, paves the way. And then there's the more recent kind of the economic recession. We saw a lot of farms popping up out of that and small-scale projects on vacant lots. So it just seems like there's a lot of youthful energy. So it's, again, this next generation maybe have grown up being a little more inclined toward being environmentally sound and knowing where things come from, and now they're making farms.
You know, I think a lot of people are under a misconception that, you know, oh, what can you do with a little farm? That a farm, in order to be anyways viable, you need acres and acres and acres of land. Can you address that situation?
Yeah, that's a great question that we ran into a lot on our trip across the country. And the urban farms are small. They're not by no means the solution to feeding masses of people and production levels. But there's ideas on urban farms, and there's visionaries who are working and creating those farms. And I think they're almost like think tanks as far as we found, in that there's really great ideas on how to grow and also how to incorporate food growing, whether it's on a small farm or a mid farm or hopefully into the larger farms, how to incorporate lots of kind of social services and education into that.
You know, there is a statistic out there that I can't vouch for the veracity of because I only read it in the last couple of days, but I remember being at a source that I...
So it's possible that Francis is making this
up. It's possible that I read it in a dream, but I actually think it's true. But I believe the statistic is in the 1950s, something like 48% of the fresh vegetables consumed in America came from Victory Gardens in people's homes.
That's completely untrue.
That is untrue?
I'm just kidding. I was like,
you're calling me out of my own show? I can't believe it. So let's all Google that and write me if I'm right and congratulate me, or write me hate mail if I'm wrong. It's francis@restaurantguysradio.com. But, you know, when it's amazing if you take a quarter acre and you grow a quarter acre. That's enough for a kitchen garden for a restaurant to really have an impact on what they serve. And for a family, especially if you're able to put stuff up and you know how to preserve things, or you have a freezer that you can use for certain vegetables, it is amazing the amount of really good, wholesome local food. And remember, when you transport food, every day it loses nutrients. You know, if you eat it the next day, it's full of nutrients. It's amazing how much food you can get out of a small patch of ground.
Right, yeah, and that's, you're talking just on the micro level of having a little patch in your backyard to feed your house, which is a brilliant way to do this. And we saw it happening on some of the tiniest plots you could imagine. In East New Orleans, there's a Vietnamese community there that is kind of in a classic 1960s, you know, suburban grid, and they have tiny little patches between their driveways and their fences, and they're growing unbelievable amounts of produce that they just use in their house, and sometimes they sell the leftovers. So it is all about the spectrum of, from that backyard where you're growing it just to supplement your own nutrition in your house to growing it to sell and to supplement your income.
David, my father, when I was a kid, had a farm that my grandmother lived on, and we'd go up to every other weekend or so. And, I mean, the total amount of area that we farmed was a quarter acre, a third of an acre. Maybe some years it was as big as a half an acre. But we produced ridiculous amounts of 25 or 30 different kinds of food. I mean, it was diverse. It was different every year, and it was more food than 8 or 10 people could possibly eat in a year. I mean, I really think it's important that people understand how much food can grow from such a small area.
Yeah. Well, that biodiverse practice of growing in those intensive methods is, again, that's some of the ideas that are happening out of necessity on the small plots that cities are made available. And so you're transferring that onto like a half acre, or, you know, when you start talking acres out in the more rural areas versus square footage in a city, then if you can use those same practices, then, yeah, just imagine how much food you can grow and the diversity of it.
So let's talk about your book and specifically what concerns your book as you traveled around the country. And this is we should lay out to the listeners that this is a story of many different urban farms that you visited and with really intelligent lessons gleaned from each one. Because, of course, the thing about these urban farms is they're adaptable to their environment because the city is sort of there and we build the farm however we can in that city. Who are the urban farmers? Is it a community-based organization? Is it a for-profit organization? Are they for restaurants? Are they for the local community? What have you found out there?
Well, I found that it's everything. That was the fascinating part. It's sometimes an organization, a nonprofit organization that started like in Denver. The Denver Urban Gardens started to support and facilitate new farms, and whether they're just a tiny little plot or it's more of a community garden. And so there's those kind of classic, which I think is what most people consider when they think of a community garden or an urban garden, is something that's kind of shared amongst the community. But then there were for-profit farms, and those are the really interesting ones, I thought, most important ones maybe even, because they're actually out there as entrepreneurs, you know, social entrepreneurs. They could be selling widgets, but they decided they want to grow healthy food and sell it to the community, and they're making profits out of it. You know, it's hard, but they're learning the lessons that I think are going to develop into good models for other farms. And then on top of all of that, whether it's a community organization as a nonprofit or some kind of hybrid of a for-profit nonprofit, they offer social services that go kind of further down in the community than you can really articulate. Sometimes it's on the surface, like they're working with homeless people, and those are their employees, those interns, or recently incarcerated, or they're working with kids or college students, and then sometimes just having an urban farm on the corner kind of adds real estate value and just general value to that community.
Well, David, I mean, you've created this book to be part story and partly to tell all these stories. But it's not just that. It's also a manual. It's also how do you get this done in your neighborhood? How do you get this done in your city? I mean, there's discussion on zoning laws and how to get them changed. And why did you think it was so important to put those things into the book?
Well, because we wanted it to be inspirational, and the inspiration could come from hearing the stories, the human interest stories from each of the farms, but then also kind of practical and serviceable if you. You know, we don't expect readers to actually look at that and say, "Oh, okay, now I'm going to start my own urban farm." But I think there is a lot of interest out there, and it is pretty easy. Well, not easy, but it's manageable. If that's what you want to do is start an urban farm, then we think that you could kind of follow this book along and get a good start. So we wanted to be inspirational on both sides of that, kind of anecdotal and also in a serviceable way.
I'm going to disagree with you for just one second, David. I think there will be people who read this book and start urban farms. I think that definitely there'll be a cause and effect there. I think it's a pretty important book in that way.
Well, that's great. I appreciate that. And we'll have a sequel. Maybe the book agents out there will hear you say that.
Well, you know, it's pretty inspiring when you look at these things. And one of the problems, when you look at all of the farm stories that you've told in this book, one of the things that is really daunting, there are a couple of movies out this year that we want to see. One is called Grow, and then there's another movie about folks who sort of sink their life savings into a dairy farm and sort of realize the financial hardship of it. You know, it's quite the financial risk, and farming on a large scale is a monstrously risky financial investment of capital, you know? Mm-hmm. Whereas it strikes me as these urban farms are, number one, to exist in a city, they need to be more nimble, and they are, and the owners, I mean, the entrepreneurialism in this book is really amazing to read. That was one of, you know, Mark and I run restaurants, but we're entrepreneurs as well, and the entrepreneurialism that you detail in the book is amazing. But also, it strikes me that a lot of these folks got in with not a huge investment. I mean, they didn't sign on to a loan for, you know, $500,000 to start the farm in many cases. They sort of converted one rooftop at a time into, you know, growing a diverse bunch of vegetables that then sort of realized an income shortly. Is that a fair assessment of one of the advantages to an urban farm like this?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of them are springing up in places that have been abandoned and land that's overlooked and kind of deemed unvalued, you know, valueless. And so I think that's made it easy for a lot of farms to either approach an organization or a property owner or a real estate person and say, hey, look, this lot's sitting there. Can we use it? On the larger scale, like if it's a city lot size type of piece, or and obviously people see the value in growing food on something that's vacant and transforming it. So it's kind of an easy request as versus like, hey, can we come in and can we build a putt-putt course or a parking garage or
go-go bar? Know. Go-go bar is an option that we tried. They turned us down. Sorry,
oh, really?
No, not at all. I actually when going before the city council, I jokingly said to one of the city councilmen when we went to open our second restaurant, I said, don't you think it would make a great pool hall? He said, you're going to get approved, Francis. Don't worry about it.
Well, yeah, go-go bar, I could see that with a farm, you know, a tiki bar selling carrot juice.
Leave the bar jokes to us, okay? You can have the farm jokes. We'll take the bar jokes. Hey, listen, we're going to take a quick break, David. We'll come back on the other side and talk about more about urban farming and how people might get into it and some of the lessons that all entrepreneurs and food industry people can learn from urban farms across the country.
And, David, I want to ask you how we get livestock up on a roof in Brooklyn.
After the elevator, stupid. We'll be catapult. You win the joke contest for the first round. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys on RestaurantGuysRadio.com and the Heritage Radio Network. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, and we're talking with our new friend David Hansen. His book is about urban farming. You can find out more about it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and we'll give you the link to the book where you can go and buy it and begin your own urban farm.
Hey, David, we were talking, and I joked a little bit about this but just before the break, but there really are urban farms on rooftops in Brooklyn with livestock. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how it all happened?
Well, the farm that we profiled was Eagle Street in Brooklyn, and it's small, 6,000 square foot rooftop of a warehouse, and I guess there are chickens up there. I don't know if you're talking about bigger livestock.
No, like chicken or live. There's
okay.
No doubt about
okay.
it.
I'm just making sure.
There's rarely a herd of them, however, so the roof can handle it.
Yeah. So, I mean, chickens are easy. I think the general consensus now is that chickens are, you know, like having a cat in the backyard almost. So just a couple cages up there, and the chickens hang out in the cages and lay their eggs and then eat some of the scraps, and then their fertilizer can be used. So it's pretty easy little cyclical addition, even on a rooftop.
You know, something that people may not realize, when we talk about, and we've talked about in the past, intensive farming operations and confinement animal feeding operations and how the waste from, you know, 100,000 chickens in one building can, and, you know, maybe 500,000 chickens in one farm, how that waste can really become an environmental problem. Well, the waste from 20 chickens is called fertilizer.
Exactly.
You know, it's a matter of concentration.
I mean, I remember, like I said, I was talking earlier about the farm we had at our house, and, you know, we had chickens, and the chicken litter was used for one thing or another. All the compost in the house, all the leftover vegetables, the ends, that was used. You know, everything gets used and turned back into nature and turned back into something. There really isn't that much waste, and there certainly isn't any waste that you need to be worried about.
And having a farm next door historically has been a good and benign thing. It was great to live next door. Pig farm's a little smelly, but most farms, it was fine to have a farm next door. When you have a modern animal feeding operation, boy, you don't want to live within 10 miles.
If you have eight pigs next door, it's not a problem.
Right. Well, yeah, and that's it. Compost is a part of the urban farming discussion that's really important and gets overlooked a little bit, but it's a great area to compost not only the farm's waste, but, you know, the neighborhood, the community's waste can be brought there and turned over and then kept kind of within the system of that neighborhood to produce food.
Talk to us about, though, there are some urban farms here where they do raise, cloven-hooved, four-footed livestock in urban areas. How does that work out?
Well, it works out well in the projects that we saw. Obviously, it's on a small scale. But, I mean, you kind of made a joke about it, but the biggest problem is just neighbors thinking, what's a cow doing? What's a pig doing, more accurately, in my neighborhood? And, you know, just the connotations that come along with pigs being nasty and smelly and causing problems, or goats eating everything. But, the city of Seattle uses goats to cull back blackberry bushes that take over everything. So I think it's just a matter of perspective, and that's part of the reason urban farms are huge, is that they're kind of breaking down those myths that, you know, how could you possibly have livestock in a city? This isn't medieval times, you know. So I think showing people that slowly and surely, that there could be a couple pigs next door, and if they've got the space they need, then everything's going to be fine, is really important.
Yeah, nothing mows your lawn better than a sheep or a goat.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah.
Doesn't even need gas. The grass is the gas.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've seen that across the country as well. Departments of Public Works using goats to, you know, tame the brush on a highway, especially difficult brush that's hard to get at with a conventional mower. That strikes me that could be a very useful, and has always struck me, that could be a very useful use of livestock in an urban environment.
Yeah, I agree. And you get goat herders. New occupations in the city, too.
Yeah, and that's actually happening, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk about the kind of obstacles that urban farms may face due to misperceptions or antiquated regulations. The first farm in your book you start is in Seattle, Washington. Mm-hmm. And the lesson, and with each one of these farms, there's a lesson that comes from it, or sort of a how-to plan to do something this farm has done that needed to do to get open. And your how-to for the first farm is to change your city's urban agriculture zoning codes. Are there unreasonable codes that keep people from making urban farms?
Well, a lot of cities will have codes, especially around livestock, that you can't have livestock, or you can only have, you know, one chicken, or certain kind of just restrictions like that that don't really make sense. They're kind of antiquated and go back to kind of a fear of contamination in city water and that sort of thing.
Right. It's okay to have squirrels and robins in my yard, but chickens would just be, ridiculous.
Right. Or to have, you know, massive amounts of pavement that run off, which stormwater runs off with all the gases and oils and antifreezes and all that. Seattle's been really... And another restriction would be, like in Seattle, they didn't even recognize urban farms and urban ag, and they don't in a lot of cities. And so you couldn't, there was kind of this gray area. Can you sell produce out of your backyard? You know, so Seattle went ahead and just said, yes, you can sell produce that you grow. It's just, like having a business as if you had a yoga studio in your house. You can obviously have that and charge people and make a business out of it. So you can do the same thing if you're selling tomatoes. So that was a big step.
And so what other kind of laws? Are there other cities that had laws as well that people have really run into and had resistance with?
I'm not thinking of any. None have come to mind other than just those basics. You know, you can't have – we're not zoned to have livestock, or, you know, kind of jumping through hoops to be able to sell food on your lot.
Most towns in New Jersey, you can't raise chickens. I mean, that's just the common – you know,
yeah,
law
chickens
in New
seem
Jersey.
To be, yeah, they're kind of the groundbreakers as far as that goes. It seems like everyone's kind of jumping on the chicken wagon, and hopefully that'll lead into more livestock.
Let's talk about another concern then of urban people who buy from urban farms or want to rehabilitate lands. There is a lot of concern. I mean, I remember when I was a kid up in East Orange, there was a watch factory from before I was born. And they came around in the 1970s, and my uncle Bill, used to raise these amazing tomatoes. And they came around and said, listen, you can't eat anything you grow out of your yard in this neighborhood, because the watch factory used to paint the dials with radium paint because it would glow in the dark, And they were done when they were done with the scraps, they just sort of dumped it in the back, and so the whole thing was contaminated. What about issues of contamination of soil in urban environments? I know you deal with that as well.
Yeah, that's a huge issue. We have a how-to on that because it's such a big dilemma for a lot of people, and it's easy to find out if you can contact your city and kind of look, and they can look through records and see how the land was used where you want to grow to see if there is that sort of industrial contaminant going on. And a lot of farms run into that, and there's multiple ways to approach it. You can spend years kind of rehabbing the soils with nitrogen fixers and with growing certain ground cover that you're going to turn over, and it takes a while. I mean, soil is you know, commodity in gardening, so that's what you bank everything on. And then in Philadelphia, near you guys, there's the Greensgrove Farm. They took over a brownfield, which is what the EPA terms a plot that's been contaminated by industrial use, and they just started with raised beds and went that way for years and years, using where they control the soil, and then it's not an issue. So raised beds are a huge solution to that.
Can you explain what a raised bed is?
Well, yeah, it could be, you know, imagine like a long hot tub kind of raised up off the ground, like that shape, with out of wood, or there's different ways to build them. And then you fill it with soil instead of water, and then you can grow whatever you want in there. And they can be long and narrow. They can be any size you want, really. Usually they're kind of subdivided, and then they have a bottom on it, so this, everything is self-contained within that one vessel.
Well, David, realize one of the reasons that Francis is so concerned with this is because Francis used to have a condominium in an old pencil factory.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And the lead poisoning, if you've now been talking to him for a half an hour, it explains so much.
that's really, we can't name that the housing development now because Mark's going to get us sued. And that's graphite, not lead, okay? So that's one area having to do with urban farming that I think is fascinating. You can rehabilitate soils over time, but if you're curious, you can get soils tested, and you point this out in the book, and we have right here the agricultural school in New Jersey is Cook College at Rutgers University right here in New Brunswick, and their agricultural extension, you know, you can get your soil tested, and you'll find out if it's good or bad, and frankly, as a gardener, you'll find out if it's high acid or low acid, and different things you can do to correct your soil in various ways. So it's cheap and easy to test the soil around your property.
Yeah.
And that's for home gardeners as well as urban gardeners. So we have a little planter out in front of the restaurant. Actually, we have two little planters out in front of the restaurant. They're beautiful brick planters, and in the summertime, we put it at a sidewalk cafe, and it has a permanent fence that's there for the season, and we put flower boxes on it. And we always put interesting, beautiful, decorative plants in there. One of the things that we're concerned about is the security of any food we were to grow in there. You know, it's in the middle of a city street. It's there at night. It's not locked in any way. And we're a little reticent to plant food there that we could use. It would be a beautiful thing to do, but I'm afraid of two things. One is someone, you know, being vandalizing the food in such a way that I don't know what happened to it in the middle of a city. You know, maybe it's 3 o'clock in the morning and someone drunk is walking by, and of course, I'm afraid of people stealing the fruit when it's ripe and just eating it. You know. And maybe I think if that were the only concern, we'd put stuff out there anyway. Is that ever an issue with urban farms? Like what goes on when you're not watching it?
Yeah, that's often an issue. A lot of them, again, since they're in kind of neighborhoods that have been blighted or abandoned, and the land's there and abandoned. There's a lot of concern over that. I think that, again, back to Philadelphia, the Greensgrove Project, Mary Seton Corboy, who's the founder of that, talks really. She speaks really well about that issue, and her main solution, which is has been repeated by a lot of other gardeners, is just to connect with the community. And obviously, when you're an operation like an urban farm, it's easier to do that. She put in her nursery plants that people in the community would like, that kind of fit in with what she was seeing on people's stoops and in their window boxes, and so that drew them in. And then once they made the connection, it was part of their community. Then they wouldn't bother with it, you know. They had an ownership in it. Now, obviously, you're talking about your one single windowsill, and you can't make friends with everyone in the neighborhood as much as you try. But it's definitely a concern among urban farmers. It's probably your concerns are probably more hard to solve than one of a bigger farm that can kind of reach out in a lot of different ways.
You know, farmers always, though, are concerned about their food getting stolen. I mean, whether it's, you know, the fox eating the chicken. You know, my brother had a cherry tree out in front of his house, and if you got to the cherry tree a day late, the birds would literally converge on it, pick it almost clean, and be gone within 2 days. Be gone if you didn't pick those cherries on exactly the right day. Gone.
But if you got there at the end of the day, the birds had a certain cherry flavor when you cooked them. Well, now you're going on you're going on tour around the country again.
Well, we're sort of a book tour, whatever we can muster. Yeah, we're going to be presenting some images on food and how people connect to it, kind of from around the world, in addition to kind of a reading from the book.
And will people be able to find information on that at breakingthroughconcrete.com?
Yes, we'll be posting when we'll be in certain places, yes.
Well, we'll put the link there in case you didn't catch that and you're driving somewhere. We'll put the link on, or you're on the treadmill running with us in your iPod. We'll put that up at restaurantguysradio.com under this show. We'll tell you all about David Hansen. We'll tell you where to get his book. It's wonderful. It's full of lessons for entrepreneurs, for people who are socially conscious, worried about food security. It's not just about urban farming, but through these case studies, we can learn a lot. And thanks for writing the book. It was really tremendous, man.
Thanks, David.
All right, thanks a lot.
You're listening to us on the Heritage Radio Network and on restaurantguysradio.com. The Restaurant Guys will be back in just one moment, so stick with us. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. I really did like this book. It came across our desk, and I thought, oh, well, here we go again. But it's more than about just urban farming. It is just about urban farming, but the lessons you draw from it are tremendous. I mean, all across the board.
Well, I think that we all could, you know, plant a little something. I do think that more and more of us are doing that in our homes. You plant a couple of tomatoes, and then you realize how much better it is when you eat the tomatoes out of your backyard, how much more your kids like it, how much more they appreciate it, how much more they understand exactly how the process works. I think that's important. It's important that we stop separating ourselves from the line of, you know, how does food get to us?
Well, and, you know, the other thing about all of these stories, all of these 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12 stories, is each one is its own self-contained story, and they all embrace what we talk about all the time is, look, we've been here for 20 years. You can't do anything sustainable unless the business or the entity that you found to do it is
right.
Sustainable, which means you've got to make a profit.
It can't just be about high ideals. Now business can have high ideals, but it can't only be about the high ideals. It's got to work from the numbers have to add up.
And in order to give back to the community, mm-hmm. I mean, if I just want to give away my money to the community, that's great, and I'll be out of mm-hmm. money at the end of the year, right? But if I want to create an engine that continues to create, and some of the stuff it creates is enough money to keep the engine going, mm-hmm. and, you know, to pay the people who run it,
it creates jobs,
and
creates
wage.
Food. I mean, those are the types of things that David was talking about.
But with that, you know, you make that engine something that's good for the community overall. And each of these 12 stories have done that in a different way, and they're nimble, smart entrepreneurs. And I think that's fascinating. So, and that's the lesson is to be learned there for anybody who's interested in a sustainable business. You have to sort of love the business and then make it sustainable. You can't just say, hey, I want to do something sustainable, and I don't particularly care what it is. It's not you can't live that way.
That's not how
you're
not
going to have the passion to make it work. Anyway, great book. I really dug it, and I'm glad I read it. It goes in the library. Anyway, well, I hope you guys have enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I know we certainly have. I'm Francis Schocker.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys on restaurantguysradio.com and the Heritage Radio Network.